And we are back with Oklahoma Engaged Live, Voice of the Voter here on KGOU. Back for our third and final segment this afternoon with Dick Pryor, Dr. Christine Pappas, and Caitlin Howard of KGOU. We had a caller going into the break, but it looks like they dropped off in the meantime there. So nothing for you right now on the phone, Dick. There you go.
Well, that's okay, because I have a question. Yeah. And the question really is for Dr. Pappas and for Caitlin, and if anybody wants to call in and weigh in on this particular question, we invite you to do that at 405-325-KGOU. There is still time as we go until 2 o'clock with Oklahoma Engage Live. And here's the question. We've talked about fear as a motivator. Is there a point, however, at which fear ceases to be useful? At which point perhaps people finally tune that out? They've seen the images, they've seen the grainy video, they've seen the dark, foreboding images, and hear the words said in a very menacing kind of a way, and they're no longer paying attention.
Well, I think as long as fear and anxiety are the main thing that's motivating a person, if that's their main motivation for voting, then that's going to be a consistent concern for them. But I do think that there can, from the research I've been doing, there can be like an oversaturation of those type of fear-based messages to where instead of wanting to seek out further information due to being exposed to that fear and anxiety, instead they shut down. They don't want to have any new political information because it all just seems too overwhelming. So while fear can drive people to seek out new information, it can also have the opposite effect and can make people tune out politics in general. So that's something that politicians have to be careful with fear-based messaging. They don't want to alienate people. They don't want to cause people to not want to act. Instead, you know, they have to be careful in how they craft those messages that appeal to fear and anxiety, because, you know, the whole purpose is they want people to vote and to be politically engaged and to support them, rather than having the opposite effect, which fear and anxiety sometimes does have that effect on people to where they just want to tune everything out related to politics.
And I just want to go ahead.
If I just wanted to add, just from a standpoint of negative campaigning, it's just so powerful. And you were right earlier, Caitlin, when you said people pay attention to the negative ads and they don't pay attention to the positive ads. It's so effective. And maybe you've seen on TV some of the ads that Senator Inhofe is running against Abby Broyles. Like, he is going to win that election. She is not that, I mean, you know, he's so far ahead of her, yet he's saying, you know, she's going to take away your way of life. She's a threat to you. And that's very motivating. People are like, no, I don't want to lose my stuff. And so they listen to that. And so negative campaigns always are more powerful than positive. And if people feel like their economic livelihood is threatened, they are going to vote. And so that's something probably we'll always see, whether or not we see this additional layer of fear and anxiety.
Yeah. And related to that ad about Inhofe, what we typically see in ads that appeal to fear and anxiety is that they try to say that their opponent has either policies that are outside of the norm, that they're going to endanger you and your family physically, or they're going to endanger your way of life. And those are all themes that are in that Inhofe ad that you had just mentioned. And that's very powerful, especially with the images that go along with that ad. It's lots of close-ups of people crying, close-ups of the American flag, and lots of dramatic music playing in the background. And so that message, along with that imagery, that combination is very powerful whenever it comes to trying to motivate voters.
Dr. Pappas, quick question as a follow-up to that, maybe not an easy answer. And that is, when you see this kind of messaging, fear messaging, which is, as you said, as you both said, is very powerful, and it works. What does it do, though, to the body politic? when it's not just an opponent, it's not just someone who has a differing point of view, it's the other person is evil. The other person is just awful and would end your way of life. That kind of messaging, what does that do overall to our culture?
Well, it's really bad. It's really bad for the for our civic health to demonize the other side. Whatever side you're on, we are all still part of this country. And it's not helpful. For example, when a party loses an election, like they, you know, if everything is undone, like they take over and they undo everything, we can't see the other side as an evil side. It's just another view. It's another a party, another approach. And we have to have respect for the political views of people on the other side. So it's really damaging to our ability to create policies that represent all people when these ads are designed to pull us apart. Most Americans are moderate. I would say even most Oklahomans are moderate. They are not represented by the people on the extremes. Yet that's what these ads are trying to do, is to drag us to the extremes and away from one another. And I think in the time of COVID, this is even worse, because our social capital, our ability to come face to face with people that are different than us, is completely taken away. We're not seeing people at community meetings, at city council meetings, at our churches, at school, at the grocery store. We're not seeing people. We're not seeing our fellow man at any point. So it's easier to believe these fear tactics that smear the other side.
And just want to interject here. We had a call off the air during the last break there, simply asking about the process of voting. As you mentioned, with COVID, how different it is this year. About two stamps on your absentee ballot. Is that true?
That is true. Put two stamps on your absentee ballot.
The ballot itself, the return ballot, says first class mail, but it does not indicate to what extent, what amount. So even if you have a forever stamp, two stamps.
Understood. Well, yeah, just a concern from a caller there. And it's a public service as well to try and make sure that people are properly voting this fall, as you've talked about throughout a large portion of this this hour. One other question from Sandra that we had via email is, what is the law in Oklahoma as it relates to poll monitors or monitoring? In some states, they're called the challengers. We've heard some concerns about being short staffed when it comes to those types of folks this fall, who are usually pretty vital to the smooth running of the election at locations.
Well, I think we might be talking about two different groups of people, because first we have the poll workers who go in and they run the polls. But then, they are in short supply. Many are older and they might not be able to or willing to risk their health to be providing this vital public service to people. But then the other question is, might be about poll monitoring, where people can actually go in and try to observe what's going on in the polling booth. Or not booth, but in the polling location. And I'm actually not sure what the law is. It's different in every state regarding whether outside people can go in and observe, but it is a public place. And I imagine that people could go in as long as they weren't disrupting the system. But I'm not actually positive about that.
And there are laws in place that restrict electioneering in the vicinity of a polling place. And presumably that would include people that are electioneering.
Yes, but would it exclude folks that are just standing and watching who aren't speaking? I don't know. They might ask people to leave if they're not actually participating in the process of voting.
And next week on this program, Oklahoma Engage Live, Voice of the Voter, our guest will be State Election Board Secretary Paul Zirix. So we will have more questions, I'm sure, along these lines for him next week. Here's another question that I think might be relevant as it relates to the information people are getting. And that is this, we have seen obviously, and you mentioned it, that there's a lot less in-person interaction now because of campaigns. But our Oklahoma Engaged polling done through OU Poll showed that debates and party affiliation are the most influential sources of information that drive likely voters' decision-making. And interestingly, social media, Twitter and Facebook rated last among likely voters. Dr. Pappas, does that surprise you?
Well, I think it's awesome. It made me smile a little bit because I too am a bit of a keyboard warrior, and we all feel like our contributions on social media are so vital, but in fact, they are very unpersuasive and unuseful to most voters. So that's really funny. So it's very well known that political ID, party ID, actually does drive a lot of our cues about who we vote for. And so these, a lot of times the cues are most useful on down ballot races. Maybe we don't need our party cues to tell us who we want for president or senator, but when you get down to the lower races on the ballot, the down ballot races, party and it is a very important cue for how to vote. It's also one of the motivators for voting. If you've gotten an email or a text or a flyer about get out the vote, it's the parties that put those things together. So that's not surprising to me at all about party.
And among undecided voters, party affiliation, this is undecided voters, party affiliation in our polling recently done in September ranked party affiliation last. Among undecided voters who said debates and actually meeting the candidates, which is almost impossible right now, as their first and second rated sources of information. So if you can't meet the candidates, undecided voters are in a bit of a quandary right now.
Right. And that party label doesn't probably mean much to them. If they're undecided, they're removed from the process. They're not reading a lot into the party labels. So that's not surprising at all. They probably would want to say, I'm going to vote based on who the person is and not what their party is.
And Dr. Pepper,
remember our call, yeah. Our call-in number, let me just say real quick, sorry, but Logan, our call-in number, if you have a question or a comment, is 405-325-5468. That's 325-KGOU. Or you can also send us an email at KGOU News.
I'm interested to get Dr. Pappas's thoughts on this, and it's something that we've kind of seen a little bit in the zeitgeist as of late. This question comes from Haven. What do the American people do if Biden wins the election, but Trump refuses to concede? So if it becomes obvious that he lost, that Trump lost, but then refuses to go, to claim that he did win, what is there a mechanism? What happens next?
Well, isn't that the biggest question on people's minds these days? The simplest answer is he is no longer president as of January 20th after the inauguration time, and he would be removed by the police and he would be removed from the White House at that time. Now, obviously, if he's going to try to stay over, it might get messier than that. It might become more military than that. It's unclear. But once if he loses the election and once Biden is sworn in, he doesn't have a legal right to be in the White House, and he would have to be forcibly removed should he not just remove himself.
Yeah, yes,
so indeed. I'm sure that's not a very happy eventuality for the United States, but that's what would happen.
And likewise, if the challenger refuses to concede or takes several days to concede, which could indeed be possible. It could go either way this year for either the incumbent or the challenger to take a while to actually wait for the votes to be counted and feel comfortable in the outcome before conceding. What happens if that occurs?
Well, we got a foretaste of this back in the year 2000 with the Bush and Gore presidential election. And it took 36 days for the Supreme Court to finally make a ruling, finding that George Bush had won and Al Gore had lost, and Al Gore at that point conceded. I think America needs to be patient, and it might take a few days or weeks to really untangle everything. And really the issue would be if on election night, it's not clear who won, because there are lots and lots of uncounted absentee ballots. It would be the challenges of the absentee ballots and getting those counted. That's the thing that would take the longest. The thing that would alleviate this eventuality is if the election is very, very clear. So if, for example, either Trump or Biden wins in a landslide in enough states that it doesn't matter how many, you know, we wouldn't have, we could call the election earlier, and whoever had lost would probably concede. So a landslide is really the only thing that's going to probably cause the election results to be known on that night.
We do have a couple of callers trying to get in here toward the end of the show. Just have a couple of minutes left, but let's try to get them in. I believe this is Dan in Choctaw. Dan, are you there?
Yes.
All right, Dan, how about Hello? Now? Yes, indeed. You're on the air. Go ahead, Yes. Please.
Yes, this is Dan. I just wanted to throw out there that for people that requested a mail-in ballot, if you don't want to mail it, you can also get it filled out, notarized, however you want to do with your ID, and take it down to the election board and hand it to them in person. That's what we did, and there were tons of them already there, so a lot of other people are doing that also.
Very good. Thanks so much, Dan, for calling in. I believe we do have another one here. Caller, give us your name and your question there.
Yeah, my name is Jim, and my question is I would like to correct something that your guest had said regarding polling places being public places and that anybody can go in there, when in fact the only people permitted within the polling area, within the voting area, are people that are there to vote.
And we had actually had a little bit of a Twitter chatter as we were talking about that a little while ago, and a couple folks saying that, yeah, it can be pretty easy to get in trouble with the law whenever you're hanging around polling places in Oklahoma. So, yeah. Dick, we've got about another minute or so, if you have any last questions for either of our guests.
I do for Dr. Pappas. And as you look at this election, we've been talking a lot about more the national side of it. How much of a pull in a presidential election year is that for the down ballot races? How much does what you do at the top of the ticket translate down ballot into those state offices and those federal offices such as U.S. Senate or Congress?
Sure. Well, it's such a big effect that political scientists don't usually study presidential election years in the same basket as other elections, because so many people come out to vote in these elections and they might have a little bit different political behavior. So we expect to see a lot of coattail from the presidential voter, and then they want to vote on all the other down ballot races. But Oklahoma only has 49% voter turnout. We need to do better, and this is a great time to get out there and show who you support and make your vote count.
Let's make that be the final word. Dr. Christine Pappas, Chair and Professor of Political Science and Legal Studies in the Department of Law, Politics, and Society at East Central University. Thanks for being with us on Oklahoma Engage Live. Back to you, Logan.
Thank you very much, Dick, and thanks to Caitlin Howard as well. We'll be back next Monday. It's Oklahoma Engage Live, Voice of the Voter on KGOU.